This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Coming up, a nasty question. Could the closure of the Strait of Hormuz help save us from hellish climate change? At least 20% of the world's oil and gas has been shut down. What does it mean? Fertilizer, refined gas, propane, and diesel too. The awful bright side of this crazy war, or is it? Then two scientists with unseen stories of climate change, from Greenland to global sea life. But who can focus on anything with explosions all around us? Not just cities and oil tankers. Long-held institutions are crashing up pretty well in every country. There is so much sadness and trauma around. I have to play this little song.
What if I just blow up the world?
You can download that piece, What If I Blow Up the World, and a couple of new tunes that are coming up in this show. Find them in the weekly Radio EcoShock blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. All free, of course. As you hear in this week's music, I am torn up by the crazy human suffering buried in the headlines. Little kids are huddled in basements. Families are strewn out over the pavements as refugees. There are explosions all around. Dreams of living are shattered by the insanity of a few leaders, their cultish followers, and military men. Meanwhile, this year's Arctic sea ice is set for another record low. unseasonal heat appears around the world? If the forecast of an El Niño event is correct, it is only going to get hotter by the end of this year. The last El Niño in 2023 was a burner, breaking heat records, burning out lives, burning down forests. 2023 was a heat step that never went fully down again with this past year's La Niña. Each time, El Niño rides our nonstop emissions, pushing further up the line to climate hell.
Is it a good thing?
Knowing the climate emergency is here and real, we can ask, is losing Gulf oil and gas a good thing for the climate and, in the long run, our civilization? Climate activists, all the worried people, see a rapid drop in fossil fuel burning as a prerequisite to saving a livable climate. This may be it. For an unknown amount of time, roughly 20% less oil and gas is available for the world to burn. In this view, the longer the Strait of Hormuz remains closed, the better our chances. Emissions from burning many millions of barrels of oil and gas do not happen. That strengthens the push for alternative energy and electrification. Bad-mouthed green development gets translated into a pressing national security issue, and we can all see it. There is a private ferry connecting an island in the Philippines to the mainland. It's tropical, there are fruits and flowers, and like many in the developing world, this ferry is privately owned. It is a hub in the local economy, essential to the lives of many poor people. Now the ferry is not running. Fuel is just too expensive, and the owner can't raise ticket prices for people already living at the edge. As always, the poor in America and around the world suffer first in these emergencies. The rich will pay anything for gas. People without the means do without a lot, like using a car, eating meals, heating or cooling, electricity, jobs, holidays. This means deep cuts for millions of people. Nobody is cheering this unplanned excursion into an energy shutdown. Just a couple of decades ago, professors and peak oil activists called for a planned descent, organizing group withdrawal from our addiction to fossil fuels. It was to be humane, and maybe it could deliver new benefits of enjoyment in our lives. That was turned away by something, profits, habits, who knows. Now we have the worst case, a sudden shutoff leading to earthquakes in the economy and possibly the fall of governments. The Greens never wanted to cut greenhouse gas emissions with a senseless war. But here we are. Can it work? In theory, a sudden 20% drop in available fossil fuels might seem like a win for the atmosphere. But as of March 2026, real-world data suggests that the Iran war shock could actually lead to a net increase in certain types of greenhouse gas emissions in the short term. The impact is driven by a phenomenon called fuel switching. The world's energy system scrambled to replace clean-burning gas with dirtier alternatives, like coal. The biggest climate risk right now is the loss of Qatari and Emirati liquefied natural gas, in some people's views. Countries like China, India, and Vietnam spent the last decade moving away from coal towards natural gas to reduce smog and carbon. With LNG prices up over 75% this month so far, and supply physically blocked by the Strait of Hormuz, these nations are being forced to restart aging coal-fired power plants to keep the lights on. Because coal is roughly twice as carbon-intensive as natural gas, burning coal to fill the gas gap can increase total emissions to rise, even if total energy consumption falls slightly. Also, as covered in last week's Radio EcoShock show, this is a war against the atmosphere. All the military jet fuel burned, the missiles, the Navy ship fuel, the logistics, it adds up to significant emissions that replace some of those hoped-for reductions from oil and gas faltering. Plus, as countries bomb oil refineries, storage tanks, and pipelines, fossil fuel emissions leak out into the atmosphere, likely for long periods after the war ends. There are other problems with the supposed wartime emissions cut. For example, ships are being diverted around Africa the long way, adding 10 to 14 days burning heavy fuel oil for every voyage. Other countries restart their oldest, least efficient refineries at maximum capacity to compensate for the loss of refined products. It is so complex. We may only know whether this war actually helped reduce greenhouse gas emissions or not, from what they would have been anyway, in a few years' time when all the data comes in. I often wondered, even aloud in my blog, whether climate disruption will be so severe that some countries bomb coal mines and oil wells in a desperate bid to control emissions. And here we are. I would not want to count on climate benefits from the blockade of the Gulf or any other part of this strategic blunder. War is not the answer to anything. Prophet of the lie. Did you want the dawn to win? Those movie scenes. Did you admire Tony in the mop? Nice country you've got there. Shame if something happens. Dropping from the sky. In a time when bad guys win, we profit from the lie. Pesky journalists, nobody needs them, no. Thinking minds need not apply, oh no. Get off the hit list, get on the thrift list. Learn how to profit from the lie. Gains and cars, gotta walk through closet with gowns made for the stars. Got a house in Portugal, a town home, a free pass from the law, a wall, a gun, a wet bar, got it all with the profit of a lie. See my gold card, my gold watch, my golden running shoes, my golden ballroom, gilded bathrooms, penthouse in the sky.
Radio EcoShock.
If living things in the ocean are killed or damaged by rapid changes in ocean temperatures, we are all in big trouble. Ocean life provides oxygen that we breathe. The fisheries from there, they provide key food for billions of people. And amazing life in a billion forms in the sea, they have their own rights to keep living without our permission, our interference, or our needs. What will happen to fish as oceans heat up? Can we assume bad news? We have answers in a new paper. Long-term warming reduces fish biomass, but heat waves shift it. We reached out to the lead author, Dr. Shahar Chaikin, with a PhD in marine ecology. Shahar is currently a postdoctoral fellow with the Department of Biogeography and Global Change at the National Museum of Natural Sciences in Spain. From Madrid, Shahar Chaikin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for having me.
What got you interested in the future of fish in a warming world?
Well, that's a good question. I'm originally from Israel, which is in the east part of the Mediterranean Sea, which is can be considered as a global hotspot for climate change. So as I grew up, I've seen the sea that I really like getting warmer and warmer over time. And not only that it gets very warmer and a hotspot for climate change, it's also a big hotspot for biological invasion since the opening of the Suez Canal that connects the Red Sea with the Mediterranean Sea. So this created a lot of change as I grew up under the sea. I've seen new species arriving, other species becoming less common. So being concerned about and interested about how climate change and global change in general is changing our ecosystems is fascinating me. And that is the main drive, I think, that curious me.
Back in 2003, marine ecologists like Boris Worm in Nova Scotia predicted rapid worldwide depletion of predatory fish communities. But the main concern then was industrial fishing, cleaning out the stocks, as happened to the East Coast cod fishery. Is it fair to say your new work doesn't really count overfishing or ocean acidification or pollution? You're just looking at changes in ocean heat?
So I wish to start by saying that, first of all, I don't downplay the effects of fisheries. Overfishing is a massive threat to the global marine biomass. It is true that our models focus specifically on the climate signal, the long-term warming and marine heat waves, and we did not isolate the impact of commercial fishing. However, we can be certain that the distinct patterns we found are not the result of fishing. So in our work, we found that fish populations located in the warm edge of their range are actually declining in biomass when a marine heat wave arrives. While on the other hand, cold edge populations, those in the cold edge of the range of the species, are actually increase when a marine heat wave arrives. So there are different responses. So if these massive swings in biomass that we observed were just from fisheries, we would have to assume that fishers are magically coordinating to overfish specifically during marine heat waves and only targeting the warm edges of species habitat while ignoring the cold edges. That's obviously, it makes no sense. So further, that this distinct cold edge winners and warm edge losers pattern that we see is a clear climate fingerprint. And on top of that, regions that are warming faster are actually showing greater biomass loss. And we're not the first study to connect warmer oceans with biomass declines. So because fishing inherently removes fish, the true declines that we see are likely even worse than our climate-only estimates. This is what I can say about the effects of fishing within this context.
So how much is the global ocean warming every decade, and is that rate itself changing?
So to answer that accurately, we really have to look at it in two steps, I believe. There's the global picture and the subset that we capture in our study that we report. So first, looking globally at the ocean surface, the rate is accelerating dramatically. A recent study in 2025 by Merchant and his colleagues showed that over the last 40 years, the global sea surface warmed by an average of about 0.13 degrees Celsius per decade. However, because Earth's growing energy imbalance, that rate is essentially four times faster than several decades ago. It rose from 0.06 degrees per decade in the late 1980s to a staggering 0.27 degrees per decade over the last 5 years. So the global surface heating is indeed accelerating. In our study, we focus specifically on the seabed across major northern hemisphere basins where we had biological data. So it's a subset of the northern hemisphere. We're talking about the North Atlantic, the Northeast Pacific, and the Mediterranean Sea. because that is the actual daily environment for those bottom-dwelling fish. So we focus on the seabed. And at the seabed level, we found that 93% of the areas we examined are experiencing decadal warming. The average rate was about 0.06 degrees Celsius per decade at the seabed. However, the ocean does not heat evenly, and we found some extreme regional hotspots warming at rates approaching 0.4 degrees per decade. And what our paper proves is that even these seemingly small fractions of degree at the bottom of the ocean translate to big losses in fish biomass.
I think that's amazing that not only is the sea surface temperature heating up rapidly, but the seabed itself is also getting hotter. How is that data collected? How do we know what's happening at the seabed?
Yeah, regarding the seabed, let me just do here a tiny correction. We're not talking about the temperature of the seabed. We're talking about the water temperature near the seabed. And in order to estimate that, we actually used available data from the Copernicus Marine Service that has a global ocean physics reanalysis models that are available to use. So what basically these models are doing, they're taking in situ observation, historical observation over decades. Using the supercomputers and models, they allow us to interpolate what will be the temperature in every day and in every place in the globe in a very fine resolution. So we're talking about today, we can use resolution about 9 kilometers approximately. We use this data alongside the biological data to predict how fish biomass responds to warming and to estimate the marine heat waves.
Would you tell us about warm edge and cold edge as studied in your paper?
Okay, so I think we can do here a small analogy. Let's imagine a species' entire distribution is like a multi-story house. The warm edge would be for individuals in the sun-baked attic. These will be fish populations near the equator side of the species range, near the tropics, the warm edge. On the other hand, the cold edge would be for populations in the cool basement. These will be fish populations, usually the forward edge of their range. So when a heat wave arrives, you can assume that each population will be impacted differently. This is why we see diverging impacts of marine heat waves depending on the edge of the species range. Where a fish sits on that thermal position spectrum dictates how it will respond to a sudden heat wave.
Now, to be honest, I found your paper confusing at times. Of course, I'm not a scientist, but for example, take this quote. Using population level estimates modeled across extensive regions of the Northern Hemisphere, we found clear evidence that warmer years are associated with notable increases in fish biomass, while cooler years are linked to declines. Now, reading that, I would think, well, global warming is good for fish then, but that's not really what you're saying.
Yes, so this is one of the key points in our paper. So on average, we show that warmer years result in more biomass. But this effect, positive effect, depends on the thermal position of the population. In other words, this biomass spike in warmer years is driven by cold edge populations that gain in biomass. However, populations positioned in the warm edge of the range are actually losing their biomass. So importantly, if you compare a year warmer by 2 degrees Celsius against a year that is colder by 2 degrees Celsius, you will find that cold edge populations gain about 50% more biomass in warmer years than a warm edge population will gain in a cold year. So there is some asymmetry here, meaning that in general, cold edge population capitalize better in a warming world than warm edge populations will capitalize in cold years.
And the numbers also show huge swings of fish populations as waters heat up or cool down. An increase of 176% is quite large, and a decline of 41% is big too. Is that swing of populations with temperature, is it natural, or could that also be climate-induced instability?
Based on our models, these patterns tightly follow seabed temperature. Thus, I can say that it is part of the impact of climate change is inflicting on our oceans. Yeah, so I would say it's indeed climate-induced instability.
In addition to relatively slow general warming, we see more extreme marine heat waves. According to a 2020 study, the infamous hot blob in the North Pacific, that was in 2015, 2016, it killed about 70% of Pacific cod in the Gulf of Alaska. Are marine heat waves always bad for fish, or could the hotter waters be good for some?
So according to our findings, we will say that it depends on what is your focal population. The blob marine heat wave that heated also the Gulf of Alaska is actually the perfect example of how devastating these events can be, but it only tells half of the story. So that 2020 study you mentioned found that 71% decline in Pacific cod was caused by a negative combination, the extreme heat that caused the cod metabolic demands to rise and simultaneously reducing their prey supply. The fish apparently starved. That is a scenario that can explain what may happen when a marine heat wave hits a population that is already near its thermal limit, what we call the warm ash of the species range. So to answer your question, no, marine heat waves are not universally bad in the short term. It entirely depends on where the fish are living. While populations at the warm edge collapse, populations located at the cold edge of their species range experience the opposite. So for them, a marine heat wave can create optimal temporary growth conditions, and we see their biomass actually boom by up to 176%. So marine heat waves can be good for some fish in the short term, but the warning from our paper is that we cannot let those localized cold edge increases trick us. Those gains are transient. In the long run, what we show is that the chronic warming of the ocean is predicted to impact most of the species, driving biomass down in large parts of the northern hemisphere. So even if we do get those biomass gains in the cold edge, we should be very careful and track them as they may be transient.
Here on the West Coast, people marvel when tropical fish show up in our normally cold waters. I know you have some new work out on this waiting for review, but are these exotic fish arriving due to marine heat waves, or is it due to chronic warming?
So this question actually touches on some exciting new work we have. We took advantage of one of the largest accidental anthropogenic experiments, which is the opening of the Suez Canal in 1869, a bit more than 150 years ago, where humans, we played God, and we reversed about 14 million years of geology. We connected the tropical Red Sea with the temperate Mediterranean. Without giving too much away, we are finding that while heat waves might cause temporary visits of alien species that expand their range, it is the slow, chronic, long-term warming that actually changes, explains most of the variability in colonization probability. And so this rising baseline allows tropical fish to permanently colonize the historically colder waters. But yes, this work is still under review, and these are initial findings that I can share.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Why do fisheries decline over long-term warming? What are the mechanics of the slow death that might be expected with global warming? And do you think there could be possible tipping points ahead?
First, I'd love to be transparent here. I'm an ecologist and not a physiologist. So our study was explicitly designed to measure the what, not necessarily the why, the mechanism. We quantified the empirical patterns of biomass change across numerous populations, but elucidating the precise mechanisms driving these diverging responses between short and long-term warming remains a key knowledge gap that warrants further investigation. However, we do suggest a few potential mechanisms that worth exploring and can explain this long-term decline. One of them is ocean stratification that may cause starvation. There's a sustained background warming drives those indirect effects. It intensifies ocean stratification, meaning that the warm surface layers and cooler deep layers stop mixing properly. It reduces the vertical nutrient mixings from the depths, which limits primary productivity. Consequently, it lowers food availability at the base of the food web and continuously limiting population growth and essentially starving the ecosystem bottom up. This could be one mechanism that warming may impact eventually fish biomass in the long run. Second, there's a temperature size rule. It's one explanation relates to how exotherms grow. In warmer waters, fish often experience increased growth rates initially, but they ultimately reach smaller adult body size. This could explain the initial increase in fish biomass during short-term warming due to faster individual growth. But over the long term, a population made up of smaller adults may also mean less total biomass. So this is one point that should be investigated more into depth, although there's a good evidence for that across the Mediterranean Sea. Another potential explanation could be prey predator disruptions. We have evidence that long-term climate changes can disrupt prey predator dynamics. Studies show that smaller species predation rates can increase in warmer temperature, but decrease for bigger individuals. So when we combine physically smaller fish, less available food, and disrupted biological interactions, you get pervasive impact of climate. So it could be different mechanisms that eventually converge.
And which is the bigger threat to rich ocean life? Is it long-term general ocean warming or extreme marine heat waves? Were you able to sort that out in this new work?
That was actually our goal, to disentangle long-term warming from short-term warming. This is, I think, where the novelty lays. We show that the overarching threat is the long-term warming. Marine heat waves have a local context-dependent impact. They shift biomass around, creating localized winners and losers. But chronic long-term warming is apparently an inescapable threat. We found that both cold-edge and warm-edge populations are equally vulnerable to chronic warming. It slowly and persistently reduces the biomass.
Well, suppose one country finds a huge increase in a species that it wants to harvest, and it sends out boats to get it, not knowing there has been a collapse of the same species closer, say, to the warm edge. Could this mixed reaction to warming lead to mistakes in controlling commercial fisheries?
Yes, this is one of our biggest warnings. If a country that occupies a cold edge of a particular commercial species sees a massive, let's say 150% boom in European sprat during a warm year, they might heavily increase their fishing quotas because they say, well, we're doing fine, there's a lot of fish, we can increase the quotas in this case. But if they don't realize that the species is simultaneously collapsing at its warm edge in a completely different region and declining globally due to chronic warming, they risk overexploiting this stock based on these transient gains.
Well, it sounds like we might need international management of the fisheries, as difficult as that might be. What does your paper tell us about prospects for fisheries management in coming years and decades?
I think that is exactly the danger. I was thinking about marine heat wave induced transient gains. If a country happens to be located at the cold edge of a species range, marine heat wave might cause its local fisheries to suddenly boom. They might look at those record catches and say, what climate crisis? Everything's fine, and increase their fishing quotas, right? But this is exactly why we urgently need international collaboration. Most fish species distributions span multiple countries. If we only manage fisheries on a national level, a country at the cold edge might exploit what are actually transient, temporary gains, completely ignoring that the overall biomass of that exact same species is collapsing next door at its warm edge. So if we don't manage the stock as a whole, we risk overexploiting these localized booms. To survive the coming decades, I believe fisheries management needs a bitemporal management approach. First, we need agile, short-term, climate-ready plans. This means that cross-border agreements to implement temporary fishing closures in warm-edge regions during extreme marine heat waves, while strictly monitoring the booms in the cold edges. Second, we must establish long-term strategies that don't rely on these temporary spikes, but actually prepare for the homogeneous decline of fish biomass that chronic warming is driving across the globe.
What are you working on next?
I'm incredibly excited about my next project because it tries to fix a major challenge in how we currently predict climate impacts on marine life. Right now, most of our predictions rely on oceanographic metrics, like defining a marine heat wave just because the temperature crosses a certain historical percentile across the baseline. But that assumes that all species respond the same way to a statistical anomaly and basically just assumes warmer is worse. So it lacks direct biological relevance. Survival is not just about how hot the water gets, it's also about how long the fish is exposed to that heat. So thermal stress is a cumulative process, not just a momentary event. So what I'm working on now is with colleagues is bridging up the gap between ocean physics and actual fish physiology. So we're combining ecologists and physiologists in this work. We're integrating fish surveys with daily temperature data, as we did, and laboratory-derived thermal tolerances that will measure different locations around the globe in different independent studies. Instead of just looking at traditional marine heat wave thresholds, we are trying to focus on the mortality probability. So we will add a macrophysiology component to our estimates, hopefully achieving more accurate responses of fishes to a warming world.
I'll be looking for your work going forward from Spain. We've been speaking with marine ecologist Shahar Chaikin. He is the lead author of the new paper, Long-Term Warming Reduces Fish Biomass, But Heat Waves Shift It. That was published February 25th in Nature Ecology and Evolution. You can find links to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Shahar, I look forward to your new work, and thanks for spending time with our listeners.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Wherever you live, we suffer through extreme heat waves. On Greenland, amplified heating leads to extreme melt events that haven't been counted up to now, and they can change the ocean and the weather far away. Water from Greenland glaciers could eventually flood coasts and drown island nations. It takes a long time, though, right? Except new science shows record-breaking Greenland ice sheet melt events. Just like short but deadly heat waves, extreme ice events are here and they are growing. The lead author in this new science, published February 26th in Nature Communications, is Dr. Josep Bonsoms.
Thank you very much for the introduction.
Right, and you're a researcher and postdoctoral lecturer at University of Barcelona in Spain, and you did your PhD about climate impacts on glaciers in Greenland. What is an extreme melting event on Greenland, and please describe one?
One extreme melting event is a kind of a heat wave, but for heat wave, we normally quantify the impact of a heat wave based on air temperature. And for extreme melting, instead of using current temperature, we use meltwater variables, which are modeled using regional climate models. But it can be also modeled using observed based on remote sensing data or automatical weather stations. So basically, an extreme melting event is a period of a lot of melting in the ice sheet, and this is driven by thermodynamics and circulation changes.
Are these melting events mostly clustered near the ocean, or can they happen deep inland or even at high elevations?
It can happen everywhere. Like in Greenland, we have peripheral glaciers and ice caps outside of the ice sheet. Then we have the ice sheet, and there's also many parts of Greenland that are covered by seasonal snow cover. So an extreme melting event can happen everywhere in the island.
Your paper describes a number of extreme melt events developing in Greenland, but does not reveal how long these events last. Is an extreme melt measured in days or weeks or what?
Yeah, basically an extreme melting event can be quantified in days, but also in months. And it's normally quantified using a percentile approach, so the days that are over the 95 or 99 percentile based on historical climate data are classified into extreme melting episodes. And we know very well that extreme melting events are increasing in frequency, so the number of days of extreme melting are increasing, but also the magnitude and also the spatial extension of extreme melting in the ice sheet is moving towards higher elevation. So in the past we had melting events only next to the ablation area, but now because of climate change we are observing also an increase of melting in the accumulation area and in other parts that in the past was not very frequent to observe extreme melting.
Well, scientists have long studied and modeled how much the Greenland ice sheet is melting and its contribution to sea level rise. They developed standards based on long-term melting. How does the loss of water during extreme melt events compare to that general glacier loss over a year or over a decade? Is it significant?
Yeah, normally in the Antarctic and the Greenland ice sheet are contributing to the sea level rise in the entire Earth. And then we have another factor, which is thermal expansion. I mean, the thermal expansion of the ocean. So basically, the melting, the Greenland ice sheet accumulates ice and snow during winter, but then during summer there's positive temperatures that drive melting, especially in the ablation area and in the peripheral areas of Greenland. So there are many parts of the Greenland ice sheet where the total accumulation minus the ablation is negative, but there are still some places in the ice sheet in the accumulation area where there are gains of mass during the total year.
It's easy to assume the cause of extreme melting on Greenland is just global warming. The Arctic's warming about four times faster than the rest of the world. Is the general warming the main driver of these extreme melts, or what did you find is making these things happen?
We found that the increase of extreme melting is driven by thermodynamics, which is the increase of temperature under the same circulation weather types. So this is explained because there's more energy available for melting in the atmosphere, and this is totally linked with the greenhouse gases emissions. So in the end, the increase of greenhouse gases drives more incoming and long-wave radiation, also because the albedo, so the reflectivity of the ice sheet, is decreasing. And then there's another factor related with the circulation, so the air masses movement, and we detected that there's an increase of the blocking events, so the anticyclonic weather events during summer in Greenland that drive extreme melting. So in the end, we have more temperature, but also an increase of the synoptic conditions that can drive positive air temperature and in the end extreme melting events.
It was first reported in 2012 that surface melting had occurred virtually across the entire Greenland ice sheet, including the normally frigid region at the highest elevations. I remember when that happened. Tell us about that extreme melt event.
Yeah, in August and July 2012, as well as in 2019 and more recently in 2021 and 2023, there were extraordinary melting events in the ice sheet that were driven by anticyclonic weather systems, so by blocking conditions over the ice sheet during the summer. So the decrease of the albedo, so the reflectivity of the Greenland ice sheet, amplified this positive temperature. And especially during 2012, the melting was also recorded in the summit area of Greenland. And it was especially important because they compared it the extreme melting event of 2012 with previous melting events, also using paleoclimate data, so using ice cores, and they realized that the event of 2012 was very extraordinary and not observed in many paleoclimate registers. So these kind of events are happening now more frequently because of increase of temperature in Greenland, and we know very well that, for instance, the event of 2012 or 2019, they don't have a dynamic precedent, so they don't have any synoptic precedent in the historical climate period.
Wow. So this, as far as we know, is not a normal state. It has never happened before.
Yeah, at least when I say like historical climate period, I refer to 1950, when we have one of the most used terrain analysis data. But for these extremely melting events, such as 2012 or 2019, we know very well that they are very rare in the entire late Holocene to present evolution of the climate in Greenland.
Okay, and you find the number of extreme melt events on Greenland are increasing and becoming more intense in recent decades. So you found records and methods documenting increasing melt events on Greenland. What happens if you take that upward curve of events and model it out, say, for 2 degrees of warming by 2100 or even 3 or 4 degrees of warming?
We know also very well that if we follow the current greenhouse gases emissions scenario, by the end of the century, these kind of extreme melting events can happen around 3 times the magnitude of the present day magnitude. So we know that that each degree of temperature matters, although we have the Greenland ice sheet, so all of the ice in the ice sheet will be still conserved even in 2300.
On Radio EcoShock, Dr. Andrew Crist explained large parts of Greenland have been ice-free within the last million years. That's very surprising. And then on the other end of the world, NASA scientists said some Antarctic glaciers have passed a point of no return, saying they were sort of unstoppable and irreversible. In your expert opinion, Josep, do you expect large parts of Greenland to become ice-free eventually? And if so, what kind of timetables are possible in a rapidly warming world?
We know that in the mid-Holocene, the temperatures were slightly higher than in the present day, but because of natural climate variability, and since the 90s, we are observing also an abrupt increase of temperature and melting in the Greenland ice sheet. But this is not explained by natural climate variability. It's explained because of the increase of greenhouse gases emissions scenario, as well as the albedo decay in the glacial and especially in the southern parts of Greenland. So we know very well that the accumulation area of Greenland, many parts of the accumulation area, will be covered by ice and by snow in the next 300 years. But we also know very well that the equilibrium line altitude of the Greenland ice sheet and the ablation area will move towards higher elevations, and there's a big confidence about these changes by the end of the century and in the next century.
The year 2023 set all kinds of records, from hottest year ever to that point, and deadly heat waves across the world. Canada was on fire. There were marine heat waves. Did the 2023 El Nino hot year set any Greenland meltwater records?
Yeah, in Greenland, there was a big melting event in the end of 2023, in the end of the summer, so in August. And El Niño is indirectly related with the melting of the Greenland ice sheet because it modifies the North Atlantic ocean climate patterns. And in the end, it can change the circulation weather types in the Greenland ice sheet. So normally they are connected. Also the circulation weather types in the Arctic are connected with the climate in Northern Europe. So in the end, all of the climate system is interconnected. And in 2023, we also observed an extreme melting event in the Greenland ice sheet.
Anybody paying attention hears about extreme weather events all over the world, but until now, I did not know about extreme melting events on Greenland. Is there a place or a community where this is being monitored? And how can it be communicated like it's a news event?
Well, there are many projects, especially in the University of Copenhagen, for instance. We are working also with people from the University of Liège that they develop a regional climate model, but then there are other people working in the same topic in the University of Amsterdam, and then also people in labs in Switzerland and in the United States, for sure. I think it's important to communicate that, and there are many platforms and places that we can translate the results into some kind of news that can be understandable for most of the population. For instance, I'm thinking about YouTube platforms or even in social media, and there are also kind of events that are very useful for translate the scientific results into the political sector, such as the COPs, the Conference of Parties, that are organized every year. So I think that there are many ways of explaining the results that we are finding in science into a broad society and for the political sector.
From the University of Barcelona, we've been speaking with researcher and postdoctoral lecturer Josep Bonsoms. We talked about his new paper called Record-Breaking Greenland Ice Sheet Melt Events Under Recent and Future Climate. You can find links and more in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Josep, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Thank you very much, Alex, for the interview.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
O heavenly grid, help us bear up thy standard, our chevron flashing bright across the Gulf of Compromise.
So in March, during the Gulf debacle, 32 member countries of the International Energy Agency, including Japan, the United States, and European nations, agreed to release oil from the national reserves. Experts have serious reservations about whether opening petroleum reserves will accomplish anything meaningful. The oil reserve promised represents about 4 days' worth of global consumption, 100 million barrels a day, more or less, versus 400 million barrels promised from the reserves. Getting the oil out of those reserves is quite slow. In the United States, experts estimate it will take 4 months to deliver 172 million barrels of oil from the strategic reserve as promised by the Trump administration. Meanwhile, prices stay high. This reserve seems more like a ploy, a mirage. The transfer may be stopped at any time by the president if he changes his mind. There is no obligation to tell the public if that happens. The one-time show for the stock market has been expended. Actual delivery over several months does little and may not happen. Of course, it's possible for all countries, including America, that nobody should be releasing their reserves right now. There is a lot longer and likely a lot worse to go. Reserves used now to keep transportation and industry as is, without any sacrifices or cutbacks, will seem wasted if that fuel is needed just to keep food trucks going later, hospitals operating, and other essential services. In the meantime, I think recreational flying needs to be dropped. Gas rationing is already in the works for several countries, and factories will shut down. More countries will only offer electricity for a few hours a day, or not at all. There is no oil reserve for natural gas, by the way. For a lot of countries, especially in Asia, either the gas just stops, or an insane bidding war grabs gas vessels on the open sea that were intended for Europe or somewhere else. For a lot of people, the gas just stops until peace arrives, and likely for months after that.
You say we're on the brink of destruction, and you're right. But it's only on the brink that people find the will to change. Only at the precipice do we evolve.
We need to talk about food, and if food fails, mass migration and its impact on politics happen. Agricultural experts say we are entering a nightmare scenario for global fertilizer markets. Between 30 and 50% of all the nitrogen-rich fertilizer, ammonia, sulfur for phosphate fertilizers, all go through the bottleneck of Hormuz. That fertilizer has stopped flowing out to the world. According to the United Nations report on closing the strait, Pakistan will be deprived of more than a quarter of the fertilizer, keeping their 250 million people alive. Half the fertilizer for the war-torn state of Sudan comes through the strait. At least, it did. The real impact, including mass hunger or starvation, may not show up this summer or even in the fall, until crops fail or the harvest is greatly reduced as agriculturally addicted fossil fuel fertilizer disappears. This war will have a long tail of difficulties not easy to see now.
And that all of this is much more dangerous than one thinks. And it's not just a question of individual survival, Wally, but that somebody who's bored is asleep, and somebody who's asleep will not say no.
Meanwhile, the climate emergency continues and grows. We will keep an eye on it together here. I'm Alex Smith. Download any interview or music you hear in this program free at equalshock.org. Pass them on. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
I'm gonna let you go into the heat. I'll drive around to see it. I'll fly around to make it. I'll live the way it always was. I'm in the driver's seat for the heat. Inheritance loaned on the cheap, never know, never wake up to the heat. Drama of an age.